where you have no diversity, you have no diversity issues. All of a sudden, you start bringing people in consciously. Now you've got to deal with gender, you've got to deal with race, you've got to deal with sexual orientation.
America has changed demographically and will continue to change demographically. That change has happened in the last 10 years. It's happened in the last 50 years. We are seeing a much more diverse populace, not just here in New York City, but also in places like Idaho and the middle of Oklahoma.
It's in the news every day.
It's in your social media feed, your company newsletter, and in discussions around your kitchen table.
Diversity.
Questions about its value, its broader implications, and the challenge of having tough conversations define our times.
I'm Erin Essenmacher.
And I'm Ashley Marchand-Orme.
We're your co-hosts for Future Fluency, a new podcast from NACD, the National Association of Corporate Directors. NACD helps corporate boards be more informed and more effective stewards of business. For those of you who aren't really sure what a corporate board does, they essentially oversee company performance and growth by focusing on things like strategy, risk, and corporate culture. Diversity has a big impact on all those things.
This conversation could not be more timely. A recent Pew Research Center report finds that the youngest generation in the U.S., which is sometimes called Gen Z, will be the most racially and ethnically diverse generation this country has seen.
Meanwhile, things like technology, globalization, economic empowerment, the prevalence of social media, and increased mobility have created an environment where more people have a voice. And we need diverse voices at the table to tackle the challenges that face our businesses and our society.
For this first episode, we thought it might be helpful to set the table, so to speak, to look at how the conversation around diversity and inclusion has changed over the past several decades. For that, Erin, I loved the interview you did with Howard Ross about his own personal experience watching the evolution of how companies create or don't create space for diversity.
He really does have a great perspective on the issue, and no wonder. Howard has been working in the area of diversity and inclusion for 3 decades, advising a who's who of leading companies and institutions. When he started this work, he thought he understood how to approach diversity training effectively, and then he had an experience early on that changed everything he knew about how to have conversations around race.
In the early days, we were doing some of those diversity trainings that people remember, which we did with the 2x4, you know, beat on people, especially white men, until they saw the error of their ways. And if somebody cried, it was very cathartic for everybody. But the problem was I started to see that when you'd see those people a month later, as many times as not, they'd say, that was okay, but don't ever make me do it again. It was a formula for getting people not to do stupid things, but it wasn't a formula for inclusion. It didn't really open people up to the conversation. As a matter of fact, in a lot of cases, it made them more afraid to have the conversation because of that. And so back probably in the late 80s, the early 90s, I started to notice this pattern and had a number of experiences which had me begin to question the way we were working. One noteworthy one was I was down in Monroe, Louisiana, doing some work for a newspaper, and we're doing a 2-day workshop. And on the first day, we were talking about some of the dynamics. Monroe was where David Duke had his headquarters when he ran for governor of Louisiana, so it was Old South. And people were talking about some of the race dynamics that had been down there. And there was a young man in the group. He was probably about 30 years old, a pressman for the newspaper. So blue jeans and a flannel shirt kind of guy. And he didn't say anything the first day. And then on the second morning, about an hour before we were going to lunch, he raised his hand and he says, I have something to share. And when you're a facilitator, you're always glad when you get the new voice in the room. And he said, I'm conflicted. I said, really, what are you conflicted about? And he starts talking with his head facing down to his lap the whole time. And he says, you know, I grew up in such and such an area, mentions a rural area outside of the town. And he says, my father and grandfather were my heroes growing up. They taught me to fish, taught me to hunt, taught me what it was to be a man. Granddaddy was the pastor of our church. And then he paused for the longest time, so long that I was about to say, what's your point? When he looks up with tears in his eyes and says, they were in the Klan. And the whole room inhaled. And he went on to say, I'll never forget this line. He said, it wasn't much talked about, but it wasn't much hidden either. And he went on to talk about how he feels conflicted because he really trusts these people he works with and he believes what they're saying about their experience. But for him to really buy into it, it would mean that his father and his grandfather were evil and they were the best men he ever knew. And there was something about him, you know, in those days we were trained to kind of convince him why they really were bad. But there was something about him that was so authentic and so vulnerable and courageous that he really touched me. And so instead I pulled up a chair and said, could we talk about this? And in front of the room for an hour, we just had a conversation about what that was like for him and how it shaped his beliefs and how did it contradict the things that he saw now. And finally, we stopped for lunch break, and everybody applauded him. And we went to lunch, and there he was sitting not 18 inches from the strongest African-American male voice in the room, and they're having a conversation and really engaged with each other. And I looked at them and I said, what happened to make that dialogue possible? And then I was left with two other questions too, which really became sort of pivotal for me. One was, we've always done this work based on the notion if we convince people to be good people that they would change their behavior, but this was clearly a good man, and yet his attitudes were not what I would consider to be the appropriate ones. And the second was really the more startling one, which was, could I really say honestly that if I grew up in his narrative, that I would see the world any different than him? And so that set me back on my heels, frankly. And I started to look at everything we were doing and saying, wow, are we missing something here? And so first I started to look at various different models of identity. Spent about 10 minutes with Freud and quickly moved to Jung. And Jungian models of identity are really interesting because they sort of bridge East and West. And whereas in the West, we see identity and personality as this fixed thing, like we are this way. In the East, they see it as much more something that's developed from our life experience.
Wow. So this almost sounds like the nature versus nurture debate. And it sounds like Howard is, at least in this case, suggesting that our worldviews are shaped more by nurture. I feel like that makes sense.
Yes. And though we won't go into it too much in depth in this episode, I'm excited, Ashley, for our next episode where we dig into that concept in more detail. Howard and I also talked about how this space has seen a shift in the past decade from focusing on diversity to focusing on inclusion and belonging. I think of diversity more as numbers and inclusion more as really a culture change. Can you talk about how you've seen that? You know, you've kind of had a bird's eye view into this work for so long. How have you seen sort of the approach to diversity and inclusion change? How have you seen, you know, what have you seen work? What have you seen sort of fall away because it hasn't worked?
Yeah. Well, I think what you're describing is, in fact, something has evolved over really 30 or 40 years. In the early days, we just had basic ignorance about these issues. And then all of a sudden we realized something's wrong here. We need to fix it. So we started to enact laws that gave people equal rights. And then the focus became compliance to those laws. So the earlier stages was a lot of compliance work. You know, are people discriminating? Are there cases of discrimination? Can we make sure that there's no active discrimination going on and the like? And that was sort of baseline to say, you know, we don't want this to be a negative. And then we moved to the next stage, which was, how do we get more people in? And so the whole issue of representation becomes an issue. And that's usually what we consider diversity. As my dear friend and colleague now, Janetta B. Cole, whose office is actually right next door to mine here, says that diversity is inviting people to the dance. You know, inclusion is when they actually get to dance, you know. And I think that so that becomes, but you know, you start to bring people into organizations. Now that for a lot of organizations created a real challenge because a lot of organizations didn't have any diversity issues because they didn't have any diversity. We sometimes call that the Vermont effect, you know, where you have no diversity, you have no diversity issues. All of a sudden you start bringing people in consciously. Now you've got to deal with gender. You've got to deal with race. You've got to deal with sexual orientation. And so we moved to this place that people started calling tolerance. You know, we want to establish tolerance, but I don't know about you, but I've never been particularly inspired by being tolerated by people. So there's got to be something beyond that. And I think that, that's that given where we started, that was a milestone along the way, because if we can get to the place where at least we're not bothered by the people who are around us, we can at least do something, we can at least theoretically create safer spaces. But of course, what we found was that even when organizations had large numbers of people in, that still didn't mean that they were really fully a part of the culture. To use Dr. Cole's reference, they weren't fully dancing. And this is where the whole inclusion movement came from, which is how do we get people more engaged? How do we be sure that the leadership level, as well as the rest of the organization, has diversity? How do we be sure to get people's voices heard and that sort of a thing? Now we're moving to, as you know, my new work is on belonging now. And so the next phase, I think, is, you know, how do we create environments where people actually feel connected? They actually feel like this is a place that they can call home, that they can feel like they're seen and known, can be fully themselves. And for me, that's the next horizon in diversity and inclusion work, where we can really create that place where emotionally people can feel safe and can feel like they can find their way and fully be themselves in the organizations that they're a part of.
We're going to take a deeper dive into what it means to create a culture of belonging in episode 3. But for now, we want to address the why.
Right. So why does diversity matter to companies? Well, like a lot of things, the world is changing, and changing fast. Things like technology, globalization, and social demographic shifts, like the ones we discussed at the top of the episode, create new opportunities and, frankly, new mandates for companies and for the boardroom. Really understanding diversity and inclusion is the key to unlocking long-term prosperity and growth as a company and as a country.
One person who really understands this well is Anurima Bhargava. A former investment banker, Anurima has had a distinguished career in civil rights work, including at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the Department of Justice. She's also served on several boards and is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. So she comes at these issues from multiple angles.
I think the one of the first challenges is, how do you get people to understand the relationship between inclusion and diversity and what is often sort of a conversation around the bottom line, right? And those two things are inextricably linked. And we know that not only because of decades of experience around a whole range of diversity indicators, you know, from age to background to race to gender, that if you have a team that's diverse, it's going to be stronger, right? And the kind of perspectives that people bring in and being able to have a space where people can be challenged, where they can actually think differently, those are all things that are going to make you stronger. I think we're going to see increasing pressure from those who work within corporations for those corporations to be places that are good for them to work, but are also supportive of the ways in which communities around this country, America as a whole, is a place that is diverse and inclusive and reflects the kind of values that they want, not only in the place that they work, but the place in which, you know, they reside and they live. I think we're going to see increasing pressures for corporations who want to be good actors to get those kind of pressures, not only from their shareholders and the larger community which they're a part, but really from their workers.
And the research bears this out. Accenture just released a study that shows a strong link between company values and consumer behavior. According to the study, 62% of consumers say a company's ethical values and authenticity influence their buying decisions, and 47% have stopped doing business altogether with a company as a result of corporate behavior they see as unethical or out of step with their own values. And it's not just consumers. Employees want to know that they are working for companies that take diversity seriously and are more willing to make their voices heard when companies fall short. We just saw this at Google, where employees staged a high-profile walkout to protest what they perceived as lenient handling of sexual harassment claims.
Okay, so we know we have a changing workforce and customer base that bring with them new expectations that impact how companies think about diversity. But you also mentioned technology and globalization. Those are really important to understand that. I loved your conversation with Hope Tates. As an investor, she has a keen sense for companies and technologies that are disintermediating industries. And as a woman, a former board member for Girls Who Code, and an outspoken proponent for diversity at every level, she also understands how diversity and staying competitive intersect.
The consumer obviously is changing. You're seeing the Stitch Fix and all of the delivery boxes, the way food is being delivered on media. Media is living in a digital way on the platforms. They are now the homes, and you are getting your news on Twitter. You are getting information, and the millennials don't have this whole dialogue that this is fake news. This is their source of news. They scroll and get information. They're getting also bite-sized video content. They are binge-watching content. They are no longer subscribers to cable. They are watching media on the go on a mobile-first basis where they can stop, pause, or download a whole series when they have time. They are watching and consuming in a completely different way, which also means the advertisers have to reach them differently. So there is an enormous discussion on being socially conscious. What are brands doing? They associate with brands that are doing good as well. your workforce and your consumer base. Your consumer is changing in this country all the time. It's changing internationally. If you don't have a board that reflects that and understands that consumer, are we doing our fiduciary job?
That international piece is so important, and a point that Anurima really reinforced.
We are in a marketplace that is global, and it has been for some time and will continue to be that way. If you want to thrive as a corporation, no matter what, you're going to have to figure out how to engage and work globally. And that means that that your workforce has to reflect that and thrive in that kind of global context as well. We're seeing that all the time, right? Which is workers are really demanding that not only do we actually have this be part of how we engage with each other, but also how we engage with the world. And that is something that I think is going to continue, which is, corporations are increasingly part of where we see movements, where we see how we define our relationships to one another. How do we define our relationships to the world? And in that context, like, corporations have an increasing place in making sure we do that in ways that make us stronger, that bring us together, that, you know, really value community. And so I think that's going to be one way in which we see continuing change over the next couple years and decades. America has changed demographically and will continue to change demographically. That change has happened in the last 10 years. It's happened in the last 50 years. It happens in every moment. And so we are seeing a much more diverse populace, not just here in New York City where we're sitting, but also in places like Idaho and the middle of Oklahoma. So the communities that you are serving, the communities for whom you are creating services and products, are much more diverse themselves. The communities that your workforce, where they reside, are much more diverse than they have ever been across many different lines. So that's another way in which the diversity and inclusion is here to stay. It's not something that we can actually, it's going to be part of the future of America. It is the future of America.
I couldn't have said it better myself. And together we'll spend the rest of this season exploring that future. I'm excited.
I am too. It's going to be fun. For NACD and Future Fluency, I'm Ashley Marchand-Orme.
And I'm Erin Essenmacher. Join us again next time when we'll take a deeper dive into bias.
You know, the problem here is not that people are never rational. It's that we have the wrong definition of what it means to be rational.
That's next time. Thanks for listening. Future Fluency is produced and edited by Bruno Falcon, with production support from Carrie Sheehan. Special thanks to Jeanette Woods. Future Fluency is a production of the National Association of Corporate Directors. For more information on NACD or to become a member, please visit nacdonline.org.